I'm just going to put it on the test.
Well, I'm interested in hearing is about you personally and your work. I mean, you've made a significant contribution to Alaska and its history and its direction. You've influenced Alaska with your work. And
well,
also,
shall I say I've been around a long time?
I should say this is the 27th of June, is it? 1974, and I'm Neville Jacobs, and this is an interview with Lola Tilley. And one of my memories of you, and this really isn't for a record, but you endeared yourself to me, and I'm sure you don't remember, but I was a student on campus, and I had a British Land Rover Jeep that did not have a good heater, and so my husband had drilled a hole under the front seat to draw in heat off the engine. Mm-hmm. And it was a hot spot under the front seat, and you and Jean Durand were going into town, and I was going into town, and so somehow we wound up going in my Land Rover.
Well, that's
and you sat with your feet over that hole, and it was red hot, and I was very concerned about you, and you never complained. You said no.
Well, and I suppose the reason we were riding with you is because you were always that cordial person to offer the ride. And we were not a two-car family, and the buses were not running regularly at that time. And of course, I date back to the days when we went out to the university on the Brill car.
I don't know the Brill car.
Well, that was a little Toonerville trolley on the railroad. I lived at the Nordell Hotel, and we would dash across, after breakfast at the Model Cafe, we would dash across to the railroad station and get on this little Brill car, they called it, which went out to the university at regular intervals. Anyway, it was early in the morning, always. And then walked up the hill, a long walk up from, there was a college station there, railroad station, walked up the hill. So we thought it was great when the bus system came in. Paul Greiman was driving that. And I must say that the last thing I expected in the way of progress was the blacktop roads, because we were stranded many times because of the mud, and we always had to drive out one-way traffic through the peat bog. But everyone, of course, always wants to know how in the world you ever got up to Alaska in the first place.
Yes.
And that was back in 1929. Of course, most youngsters now can't understand how anybody can live that long. I always say I was just a child professor when I came. You know how that is. But Dr. Mandel was in the States. As a matter of fact, he was in Washington, D.C. And when he wrote to the University of Minnesota, where I was teaching, saying that he would like to interview prospective home economics teachers. And the head of the department came down to my office and wanted to know if I would be interested in going to Alaska. And I said, well, I would like to interview him anyway. And he came by, and that was the beginning. Of course, I was the last one to get in to interview him, and I always say he did the interviewing because he was a great talker, you know. And he said to me, we'd like to have you if you would like to come, and the job is yours. And I said, well, I would very much like to come, but I couldn't stay but 1 year. And I didn't think it would be fair to him to come up here just for 1 year. And he said, oh, well, that's all right. If you didn't want to stay the second year, we wouldn't want you. I thought his psychology was good. And he didn't ask for a definite answer. He came on to Juneau and sat in on the legislature. It was in February when he came through, and stayed until, he always talked about the time when they turned the clock back to finish the business before the set time for the end of the legislature. It was not until he got back here that he wired me asking me for my definite answer, and asked me to bring somebody with me, another home economics teacher. So that's really how I happened to come. And that was back in, I since 1963. And since that, I've been doing substitute teaching in the public schools in Fairbanks. I'm still doing it. I've substituted in every grade from kindergarten through 12th, and every subject in high school. And the fun part, I really enjoy it. My friends say I'm the only one they know who says she really enjoys substitute teaching, but I do. It's a challenge, and I'm getting a liberal education, and I have not only the children, but the grandchildren of former university students. So it's
I always thought substitute teaching would be fun.
Well,
the variety that would come with it.
But many people can't stand it.
Mm-hmm. How did you come up when you came up?
That's a story in itself. The only way to get here was by boat, of course. And my home was in southern Illinois, so I took the train up to Minneapolis to pick up this friend who was coming to teach with me. She shared the same office and said she would like to come, and so I brought her along to teach at the university. And then we took the train, the Pullman, to Seattle. Actually, it was the first time I had been west of Denver, and so that was an exciting trip. And I then took the boat from Seattle to Seward, then by train in. And this sounds strange, I'm sure, when I say that we really didn't know how to get here. It was hard to get information, so we asked the travel agency in Minneapolis, Foster Travel Agency, to make the reservations for us. And the boats left Seattle every Saturday. That was the school teacher's special. We actually were a week early getting to the university, but all the teachers throughout the state were coming, and most of them were on that boat for the early schools, early September schools. So in that way, stopping at every town along the coast, we got acquainted with a lot of people in the towns. And in Seward, we stayed overnight. And the boat was not exactly on time, so we came on to Anchorage and stayed there for a while, and on to Curry, the Curry Hotel, which was the so-called halfway house. There were no Pullmans on the train, so we stayed overnight at Curry and got in to Fairbanks then. We allowed 2 weeks for the travel because the boat trip was easily a week, and at least 2 days or more coming in and a couple days coming across. And Dr. Bunnell sent, we came to the Nordell Hotel where we had reservations, and Dr. Bunnell sent his, one of the teachers in, got on College Station, got on to welcome us, and then he came in to the hotel and sent a car out in for us the next day to go to the university. And I must say that that trip from Fairbanks to the university was something, because there was only one house in between. And of course, muddy when it rained. And it looked, and I hadn't seen this type of vegetation before. In the Middle West, we weren't used to the spruce and the birch, and I thought it was really a sort of a godforsaken country. But everyone was so cordial, and we, of course, found living conditions very difficult because we couldn't find any place in town to live, such as an apartment. The McIntosh apartments were downtown. They were small one-room apartments, but they were all taken. So we settled for single rooms at the Nordale Hotel. I always say I owned a corner of the Nordale Hotel because I lived there for 2 years. Then we ate all of our meals mostly at the Model Cafe across the street. And there was another cafe, the Tavern, and it was all a la carte. So it was, and prices, of course, were very high. We thought we'd never seen such high prices. And the only way that we could really get well-balanced meals was to go as a group and then order one would order a full order of meat, which would be enough for two or three, and one would order a vegetable, which would be a large bowl of vegetable, another one a salad, which would be a huge salad. So it worked
like out. Like you do in a Chinese restaurant.
So it worked out very well that way. And it was a very exciting time because the university, you see, had just opened in 22, and that was in 29, and the student body was small, so we knew everybody by first name. We had a very exciting faculty group. They had all traveled. A couple of them had taught in American College in Syria, and Jimmy Ryan was there. He had taught in the Philippines, and one had been a Red Cross worker in China, and I had recently been on a European trip, and so it was a very interesting, exciting family, or faculty, I should say.
Well, it was a family too, after.
That's right, it was. Students came from all over Alaska, and quite a number from the lower 48. And at the end of the year, of course, I was really undecided whether to come back. But a trip outside is what really did it. And Dr. Bunnell didn't urge me to sign a contract. But after a summer outside, I decided, well, this is it. I want to come back. So
it's interesting how that happens, isn't it?
Yeah. For many people who debated about going out, for the next summer, I would always say, yes, go out and you can find out if you how you feel about it. There were many interesting things about the country and the university. Now, we have the reindeer as a university experimental project now in connection with the university. Well, the reindeer were there, right there on the campus at that time, in a sort of experiment, and that was, they grazed right up to the old main building. And another thing that was interesting, they had the yak out at the experimental farm, and they were crossing the yak with the Galloway cows, and they called the animal the Gallyak. And when they were slaughtering the Gallyak, the we had a big faculty picnic, and I made a big Gallyak stew in the pressure cooker. And I don't think anybody had tasted Gallyak stew before. And then another thing that
I'm just curious, you would have to tell me how it was.
Well, it was very good.
Was it like beef? Was it?
Oh,
like
yes,
beef?
Very much like beef. It didn't turn out to be a very successful experiment. The idea, of course, was to use the domestic Galloway cow with the wilder yak, and I think it was discontinued after that. Another thing that we did at that time, of course, we had many homemaker short courses, and that attracted a lot of people. And then we also had the miners. Short courses. In the winter, they would set up the what they called a mining short course for prospectors who would come in, and they would live in the dormitories. And then
they're the best living they had in a long time.
Right, it was a warm place to stay in the winter. And then they took courses. And one of the courses, of course, that I taught was camp cookery. And the and that was always very interesting. The one thing I particularly remember is one of these, they asked me in class, now if you were out at a camp and you didn't have any kitchen utensils, how would you make these biscuit? We were making biscuit in class. And I said, well, I would just take the flour sack. In those days, you know, the flour sacks were cloth. I would just roll it down and make a little depression in the center and put in the salt and baking powder and the and the fat and powdered milk, and then I stir in the water and mix it right in the sack. And this one prospector was sitting there right on the edge of his chair, and he was just so interested. I thought, my goodness, isn't it nice to have such interested students? And he would nod his head as I was talking. And then when I got through, then he sat back and drew a sigh of relief, and he said, "That's right, I just wanted to find out if you knew."
Oh, thanks a lot.
But we did have also a short course, a camp cookery short course for the credit students. And I had done that for the forestry students at the University of Minnesota. And so up on the side hill there behind the dormitory, now where you have the president's residence and some of the, probably where
the fire station is up there.
Yeah, the student union building. We, each student built a little fire, you know, and then we had camp cooking outdoors. And that was fun, too. But with such a small student body.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Did you do any research at all on the available food?
Right. We were always doing that. We did a lot with freezing. And that was preceded the days of frozen foods. Now we think nothing of having frozen foods. And so we did a lot with that. And we did baking, and our outdoor freezer was the fire escape, which we used a great deal. We made up soups and all sorts of things, and baked pies and cakes, and put them out. And when we were having our university teas, we would have everything baked and frozen for that. And then we did a lot with experimenting with fruits and vegetables. When I went back to the University of Minnesota, as I often did, as I always said, get up to date on what was going on, Ms. McNeil, the department head, said, "Why, when frozen, you know, Bird's Eye brought in the frozen foods, that was a new idea." And she said, "Ha, well, you know, that may be new here, but Lola Tilly's been doing that in Alaska now for a long time." Another thing we did was to experiment with the wild berries, and especially cranberries. The I think it was the Herald Tribune in New York wrote asking me to send some recipes that were typical of Alaska. And I thought, there's nothing more typical than cranberries, wild cranberries. So I experimented and made up a lot of recipes for cranberries and sent them. And they wrote back and said, well, that cranberries were native to New Jersey, I think it was, and that they had recipes that they might publish for that. And I wrote back and said, well, that is our big product, and those are the recipes which I want to submit. And so they did publish them. And then another thing that we did, Alaska salmon industries, canning industries, asked us to make up recipes for canned salmon. So we did a lot of experimenting with recipes for canned salmon and published a pamphlet called Alaska Canned Salmon Delicacies, I guess is the name of it. And that is listed on the Library of Congress index card, and also in the library. Well,
you know, I don't know how you got the salmon up here, or did you get
it was canned
salmon?
No, it was canned salmon. Yeah, they sent us a cased canned salmon.
A friend of mine sent me a salmon, and somehow or another, Alaska Airlines failed to notify me. She sent it up to me from Sitka. She'd caught it. She and her husband had caught it fresh from the water. Got put it on the airplane that night,
yeah,
with big labels on it. What
mm-hmm.
to do? You know,
mm-hmm.
fresh salmon.
Mm-hmm.
To notify immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently in Anchorage, it was offloaded and neglected for a few days. And by the time it got to me, it was not even dog food.
Oh, and it probably smelled.
It did. It was. I never knew how bad a fish could smell.
Mm-hmm.
In all my years along cooking in the fishing country, I never run across anything like that. But you didn't have that problem.
Oh, no, because this was canned salmon. Another thing that seemed strange at the time, of course, we had just the one building, the old main building, which was torn down to construct Bunnell building now, and then the two dormitories. As a matter of fact,
was Harriet Hess Hall was one of the dormitories?
That was before Harriet Hess Hall.
I see.
There were two wooden dormitories.
I see.
There isn't any building there now that was there when I came.
Yes.
Even the Eielson building was built after I came, and also the first building to be built was the gym, which is now the museum. See, the gym was in the old main building, and we had all of our university affairs, you know, in the old main building gym. The student dances and the plays and all that. I remember the first prom, junior prom that they had. They shipped in violets for the girls for corsages. See, in those days they didn't have to worry about corsages for the girlfriends because of
there just were no flowers.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And then when the corsages first came in, that is, they were shipped in, why, of course, they didn't know enough to protect them when they went outside, so they always froze them in between. Well, I don't know what you were asking me about, but the activities, they had many, many activities because they were such a small community, but when they started to put on the big university plays, then they brought those in to the theater in town. And we all had to do something, you know. We either took part acting in the plays, or I had charge of makeup one time and the costumes another time, and we participated as actors too. And so the town was involved, not only in the university activities, but the university people were involved in town activities too. And one of the prominent people that most people have heard about was Otto Geist. Otto Geist was then going on those expeditions to St. Lawrence Island and bringing back the artifacts to a hastily constructed museum in the basement of Old Main. And I was fortunate enough to work with Otto in sorting and going over those artifacts. And so I, with his help in describing, I wrote four articles which were published in the College Collegian magazine, and also in the National Journal of Home Economics. Dr. Bunnell was so interested in that, so he took them back to Washington, D.C. One was on the Eskimo food habits, Eskimo clothing, the shelter, their houses, and the other one was children's toys. And with those things that Otto brought back, and with his tales of how they lived, those articles described the Eskimo way of life, and those were used. I know my nutrition physiological chemistry professor at back at the University of Illinois, where I did my graduate and undergraduate work, wrote saying that he had used the article on nutrition in his class. So there were many opportunities at that time for.
What was Otto like at that time as a young
Well, man? Otto was the same throughout. Energetic, busy. He had an eye for detail, he didn't lose anything or miss anything, even for a piece of string. It might have meaning, you know. And he would, in those diggings, he would save the most intricate things. And he really started the museum, you see, and started all that, well, was responsible for that, all that archaeological and paleontological work in the Arctic.
Was that Ray Collins, I think, he originally started out with?
Beg pardon?
Otis Murray. He was with Otis Murray, and then...
Oh, yeah.
And then he went out there, I think, with Henry Collins and carried on that work at St. Lawrence.
Well,
and whoever, I may have the facts
and
wrong,
he,
whoever it was.
He took a group of students and faculty members one summer. And of course, Dr. Bunnell financed that personally for a long time. Yes.
I was wondering how that got started financially.
Yes, Dr. Bunnell personally financed it. And then I think was repaid for most of it. But most of it was done on a shoestring. That Dr. Bunnell was a remarkable person, of course. And he not only financed that, but he financed many, many students. And he found jobs. Every student worked. I think without exception, you could say that every student worked there at first. And he always, if a student couldn't swing it, hack it, as they say nowadays, why, he would either find a job or else he would advance the money. He was, he liked to, and he did everything, you know. He would sit and address the collegians. That was the college newspaper. First it was a magazine and then it was a newspaper. And he would sit by the hour and address those himself by hand. He would work in the garden. And he tells a story, which is typical, of how he, in the summer, you know, he went around in tennis shoes and old clothes. And he would show the tourists around. And one day he was showing the tourists around and one of them gave him a dollar tip. Not knowing, of course, that he was a college president. And he accepted it and laughed about it afterwards. He was great. And of course, he was so interested in all of the departments, and he had vision. And he could also see a great university. He could see that that college road would be built up. That was more than some of us could see. But he could visualize how it could be built up. I'm sure he might be surprised today. And of course, he was always trying to get money and having a difficult time. And for years, they thought they were going to move the university first to Southeastern and then to Anchorage. But it was difficult to get money. And I know one legislator, when Dr. Bunnell was pleading for money, talked about Dr. Bunnell's $50,000 woodshed up at, on the hill at Fairbanks. And the $50,000, that was the land grant. See, it's a land grant college. And the $50,000 was the grant to the university, which was to be used for salaries and equipment. And so they called it Dr. Manal's $50,000 woodshed. He was a stickler for details, and he always knew what was going on and expected you to keep hours early to late. And if anybody ever arrived on the late bus, and the late bus was maybe 8:30 instead of 7:30, why, he was always standing in the hall with his eye on his watch. Well, anyway, we knew that we were expected to keep long hours, which we did. But
didn't have union advantages.
No, he had. He really had the university at heart. And if it hadn't been for Dr. Bunnell, the university would have been closed during the military days. You see, he advanced money then, and several of the citizens in town advanced money to keep the university open. And you see, during that World War II, the military occupied the campus. We had the infirmary, the hospital in Hess Hall, the barracks in the old main building, and we concentrated and moved everything over to the Eielson building, kept a small portion in the basement of the old main for our department, and but kept the university open.
Just did the enrollment go down very much?
Yes, of course it did. But but he kept
it alive.
That's
alive
right.
And well.
That's right. He kept it going. And then he was the one that was responsible for getting the Smith-Lever funds extended to the university, that is for extension work, and by going back and pleading his case in Congress, he was able to get that. They said, why, you can't have a cooperative extension, agricultural extension, home economics extension work, because that is for the rural areas. And he pointed out that all Alaska is rural, and even in the small towns, it would be rural work. And so he was able to get the extension funds, and then the it has become the wide statewide function, you know, the extension service. I have served under all four presidents, Dr. Bunnell, Dr. Moore, Dr. Patty, and Dr. Moore. Now I always say to Dr. Hyatt that he should really find.
Are you back?
A volunteer job, so I could say I served under all five presidents. But for years I was the senior member of the faculty, and I always said senior member in years of service. It's always been a young faculty, you know, and so I would say in years of service, because at that time there were people who hadn't been there as long in years, but were older. But then it finally got to the point where I could say I'm the senior member of the faculty, and I was the senior member for some time. And now, of course, as Professor Emeritus, I am still on the faculty without pay, and still march in cap and gown at all the university functions, commencement and inauguration. I was on the committee to select the presidents from time to time. Not on the last one, of course, because I wasn't there. Well, it's been exciting to be part of history in the making, and of course, during that time is the time when I met my husband, Gray Tilley, who came up from southeastern Alaska. I always said that I came to teach at the university for 1 year at Fairbanks, and he came to Southeastern, which was Ketchikan, on a weekend cruise. I just came for the weekend and stayed. And that was, I came in 29, and he came in 23. Eventually he got up here to the interior, and that's where we met. And of course, Dr. Manel, frowned on marriage in general, and certainly would not have married teachers on his staff. And when I told him ahead of time that I was going to be married, then he enjoyed that secret and really quite approved, and kept implying to the others that he knew a secret, and he was secretly delighted. By the way, we all ate over at the what we call the dining hall. That was where the students were fed in the lower floor, the basement floor of the old girls' dormitory. So we sat at his table. He ate all of his meals there. We ate our lunches there. And so we absorbed a lot of his philosophies at the noon meal, where he philosophized all the time. And he would say, well, it would be easier to get the collegian out if some of the faculty members would just write some articles. And so we found ourselves writing for the collegian, too, among other things that we did. So I wrote a number of articles to be published in the collegian. So you can see and we didn't have what they call tenure then. We didn't, well, we knew what tenure was, but we didn't think we needed tenure because we always thought if we were doing a good job, there wouldn't be any question about being hired. But we didn't have any ideas of striking or short hours or anything like that. We just did, as they say, what came naturally.
And you were educated much.
I'm sure that faculty nowadays would be aghast at the heavy loads that we carried and the long hours. I've carried as much as 19 credit hours teaching, you know. And of course, we didn't have the numbers in the classes that they have now. Classes were smaller. But it's, as I said, it's been exciting to be part of history in the making, and it's still exciting to be connected with the university.
I have a question. If I can put my thoughts together on this. As you were directing this Department of Home Economics and formulating policy, what were some of your concerns for a new university? It was a growing, small new school.
Oh, I could always think of it in terms of a great university, yes. And for our own department, of course, we moved about three times and got enlarged quarters each time, and finally moved over to the Eielson building, where it is now. Well, one thing was a nursery school, which we didn't have at the beginning, to teach the child development and early childhood education, and we acquired that. And then the home management house, which we didn't have beginning, and we acquired that. Also, the enlarged classrooms and additional equipment. We usually had pretty good equipment, such as it was. It was rather some of it rather primitive at the beginning because we had kerosene stoves to begin with, but we certainly turned out excellent products, and the students learned a lot, and they learned a lot in management, I can tell you that. Then the student teaching, we enlarged the home economics education and trained teachers and had our teacher training in connection with the Fairbanks schools. Then the experimental cookery, the enlarged curriculum to include more courses, and a special emphasis on family relationships and marriage courses and counseling and that sort of thing.
To what extent
Did it occur to you to, or were you concerned with bringing in the unique environment of Alaska?
Oh, yes.
To the coursework?
Oh, yes, we always did that. In fact, one thing that comes to my mind of the use of native foods, we always demonstrated the meat cutting and the cooking of wild meats and uses of native foods and sourdough. you know this, you read about Sourdough Jack and his famous cookbook. Well, Sourdough Jack learned his sourdough in my camp cookery class. I always intend to write him a letter saying, you remember when, but I haven't gotten around to that. I cut out that article that was in the News Miner just rather recently to send to him, but somehow I haven't gotten around to send that. Yes, use of the native things and the native environment, always demonstrating how to clean fish and
well, how about there were a good many people living as a matter of fact they do yet today in spite of our prefab houses. They still a lot of log cabins around, and in the 30s and 40s people were living in log cabins.
Oh yes, we did a lot in homemaking in the bush, and home furnishing and home planning.
Now, the Extension Service would take courses out to areas.
Right.
Palmer and Homer and...
Right, right.
Did you, you worked directly with them?
Well, yes, and we, I was, we had that 25th anniversary of the Homemaker Short Course called University Days here a couple weeks ago, and Lydia and I originated that. And we always had the courses in our department, and we taught courses too. It was not just an administrative job. We scrubbed decks too, you know. We taught courses and administered it too. Then
you weren't just teaching theoretical nutrition. You were teaching
right.
practical aspects.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And and we always tried to make it as practical as possible. Many people have said, "Well, now you don't do this in your own home the way you have taught it." And I said, "I've never taught anything that I couldn't use every day. It has to be a practical thing." And
now, there
of course, we built our own home here. Without benefit of architect or builder, you might say. We drew, of course, Gray had some experience too, so we had all of our plans on cross-section paper and put together ideas that we both had, and then had some help now and then, but most of it we really did ourselves. That's where it was. Or I interrupted you.
No, you were answering the questions I had in mind. But one thing I would like to know about is about you and Gray. Dr. Bunnell kept the secret, but when did you actually get married?
Oh, well, we were married on commencement night on May 17th, 1937. As a matter of fact, this last alumni news has a page from the Collegian, which shows the article there, which says Miss Cremines married to Gray Tilly in that last Collegian, it was called then, which now is the alumni news, you see. And that was on commencement tonight. We had everything arranged so that we were married that night because a lot of people would be leaving, you see. And students and faculty came. And we were married at that at the Presbyterian Church in town, and many people think that little Presbyterian Church out at Alaskaland is the church. Actually, that's where I first went to church, but there was another building there at that time attached to that, and it was in that church that we were married. It was sort of contagious because after that, we had two weddings, student weddings, here in our home, and a student reception here. So we had a regular marriage bureau. Well, then, of course, Gray was very much a part of the university, and he always, with his tremendous sense of humor, he always said that he was a faculty wife. And we have the Tilly Award on Awards Day, Commencement Week, which is an award for the outstanding married student, woman student. And I always said it was not because we were promoting marriage or promoting dropouts, but we thought that a married woman who went back to school and got her degree really deserved some honor. And the last 2 years, I didn't get back from a trip outside, and so Gray presented the award personally. It was always called the Tilly Award, and this year it was called the Gray Tilly Memorial Award, which is nice.
Yes.
Excuse me. My voice is getting husky, I see. And he was always so interested in the students, and he, for many years, presented the Veterans of Foreign Wars Award to the outstanding ROTC freshman student. And was always the one who would see that the medal arrived and it was presented and everything. And we had a very nice connection with the ROTC because we had attended all of the ROTC balls. So in the last few years, they seem to have a substitute now. They don't have the military ball. They haven't had the last 2 years, I guess. Anyway, last several years we have been honor guests, and I was asked to crown the military, the ROTC queen once or twice, and we were always singled out and several times given gifts. Because we apparently were the only ones who had attended every ROTC ball, which was a nice connection. And now the thing that is that I'm very proud of is the Gray Tilly Memorial Scholarship. The contributions and the endowment will provide for an annual Gray Tilly Memorial Scholarship for the university, just from the interest.
And oh, that's wonderful.
Yes, I'm very happy about that, and I don't know how soon it will be awarded, but within the year, probably. And then only the interest will be used.
And for what particular type of achievement?
It hasn't,
or a student need.
Yes. It hasn't been, the criteria have not been set up yet for the award, but I would assume it would be an outstanding student with need and scholarship and a committee to select the person and someone who would be a credit to the university. I don't know just what that would be, but it will be an annual thing, and that's good. The other thing that memorial that I think was very good is the Medic One ambulance. The contribution, memorial contributions to that helped put that into operation. You know, that's operating now, the ambulance, I call it Medic One, which is especially good for emergencies, heart.
What did Gray do when he first came up here?
Gray worked for the Fairbanks Exploration Company.
In mining?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
He was an engineer. He went to the, he was in World War One, you know. And then on following that, he went right out of high school into the Navy in the Naval Reserve, and then was called up. The reserves were called up for World War One, and he served overseas. He made 11 trips across the Atlantic on a naval convoy, and had several trips down in South America. You were asking about how he.
Well, I asked what he did up here.
Oh, yes.
But the then background on him is interesting.
Then he went back to school then, to the university, Washington State University. It was at Washington State College at Pullman then, and also to University of Washington. Engineering was his field, and then he. That's how he happened to know so many of the his fraternity was Lambda Chi Alpha, which was Les Nerland's fraternity, and Dr. Carter, and several others that were around. But anyway, he when he first came up here, he was working for the Fairbanks Exploration Company, and then he was at Ladd Field for some time with the district engineers. But more recently, he was with the Industrial Air Products, or Liquid Air. It was had some Alaska Chemical, I think, was the name. He was in the firefighting equipment business. Firefighting equipment.
I knew he was affiliated with that company.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But he had been with the district engineers for a long
before time. That. Did you like Dr. Von Hansen go out? Did he go out mining in the field at all? Did you go out? Did you get out of town in summers at all?
No, he had that out of his system, I guess, before he came. But he was he went on a mining expedition in the Chestachina, they call it. Out of Cordova and up in that area, some place. He and a friend from Juneau, he was working with the Juneau mining, that mill, whatever they called it, there. When he and his friend decided to go on this mining on their own, which of course turned out to be not so successful. And so then he came in from that area down there, the Cordova area, into Fairbanks by dog team. Came all the way to Fairbanks by dog team. And he had some fascinating tales to tell about working on that mining project, which turned out to be
you didn't get any gold that of experience from it.
That's right. And then eventually, as I said, that's how he got up here. He eventually got here in, I think in the spring of 30. He said that he saw me, had me staked out, but I went outside that summer and I didn't see him until the next fall.
He waited for you to come back.
I guess so. Makes a good story anyway.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we weren't fortunate enough to have any children of our own, but we raised his nephew who came to live with us when he was a little boy.
Oh.
His name is Gray also, and he lived with us and went to school, grade school and high school here, and graduated from the University of Alaska, civil engineering, and he's an engineer now.
Is that so?
Kansas City, and has two children. And so, but Gray had been in the as a member of the Selective Service Board. He was chairman of the Selective Service Board and had his 25-year pin service pin. He was a member for 25 years and had a citation from the city here.
He made his contribution to evidence.
Yes. He was very much interested in that, and always he was trying to get the students to stay in school until they finished school before they were drafted, you know.
You have
and we had a lot of young people come here to see him. They always thought that he could get them out of the draft, but he said no, that that was as long as they stayed in school, that was fine, but he had no strings to pull.
Mm-hmm.
But he advised many of them, and they knew that he was fair. But he certainly believed in the service.
Yes.
And then, of course, he was very active in the Veterans Foreign Wars, and twice he was state commander, which well, that was a record because no one else was state commander twice. And he had been to many, many national conventions and really had a wide acquaintance all over the country because of his connections, and was a national on national committees. Then, of course, he was president of the, well, he was president of military engineers here for and a member for several years, and very active in that. And then at the time of his death, he was president of the Fairbanks Navy League. And he was very enthusiastic about that, being an old Navy man. Of course, people, you don't have to be a Navy person to belong to that, but it's one of those organizations which involves civilians too. And he was, of course, a member of the Air Force Association and the United States Army Association, and and was an honorary member of the Officers Club out at Ielson. And of course, he was instrumental in having that named Ielson Air Force Base.
Oh, was he? Well, you would have known Carl Van Ielson.
Right. I was here when he was killed. I was living at the Nordale Hotel at the time that they